Legoland Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the second episode of the week of the Calcio Land Podcast. This program is brought to you by Euro Fantasy Game, the home for the best fantasy football games, where you can compete in leagues that cover the top European championships, including La Liga, the Premier League, Serie A, even the Dutch League. And they also have a special Champions League challenge as well. So on today's podcast, it's the second one that we've done during the international break. So not too surprisingly, we have some transfer rumor questions. We have some questions on Serie A from listeners. In the second part of the podcast, you're going to hear an interview with my colleague from Di Marzio site, Stephen Moore, making his debut on Calcioland. We're going to take a deep dive on Lazio, since we haven't covered them too much this season. And we're going to close the podcast with me interviewing our co-host and producer, Alex Goldberg, on Chelsea. And Alex is joining me now. And Alex, we've been getting a lot of questions on Skriniar and Romagnoli, mainly from Man United fans curious to hear how they could potentially fit on their team. So I wanted to ask you, not looking at it so much as how they would fit on Man United or even your team, Chelsea, Alex, kind of in a vacuum, if you could have one of the two, which one would you pick?
All right, David. Well, I'm going to take Skriniar, and I'm taking him without thinking about it that much. And that's not because I don't rate Romagnoli. I like Romagnoli. I don't love Romagnoli, but I like him. He's 23 years old. He's experienced. He's a good defender who can still get better. He's left-footed, which I personally like, at least if you're good. I don't know why I like it. I just do. But I'm taking Skriniar because I think he's just as good as Romagnoli from a defensive standpoint. And David, in my opinion, Skriniar has something that Romagnoli just doesn't. Skriniar has got a little bit of that warrior mentality that I love in a center back. And if I'm going to look at it in terms of this year and last year, Romagnoli had a good year last year. He certainly did. Skriniar had a better year, though. In my opinion, Skriniar was probably the best center back not named Koulibaly. And now this year, Skriniar's having a pretty good year, and Romagnoli's not doing that great. So he's doing okay, but he's really not doing that great at all. So Skriniar had a better year last year. He's having a better year this year. If they're tied on all of their capabilities and actual talent, I think Skriniar definitely has the tiebreaker in attitude and mentality. That's not to say I don't like Romagnoli's mentality. I just don't necessarily think it's that upper echelon mentality that the top center backs have. I think Skriniar can become a top five, maybe even a top three center back in the world. I don't think Romagnoli can. I think Romagnoli would be more of a top 10 center back in the world. So, David, that's my take. How about you?
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what you said. So, gun to the head, yeah, I'm taking Skriniar. It might be a little bit closer for me than it is for you. But I definitely agree on the left-footed for Romagnoli. That was actually, you know, there's not that many of those with center backs. So maybe he's easier to fit in on certain teams. The thing that stood out to me on what you said, and this is the note that I have as well, is there's a larger sample size of Skriniar performing at an elite level for center back than Romagnoli. Romagnoli, I thought in the second half of last season with Bonucci, developed really good chemistry. I'd have been curious to see them keep it going another season at Milan. Of course, we were robbed of that with Bonucci going back to Juve. I'm going to pick Skriniar because of that. The thing that stands out to me about Skriniar is not only is he an excellent defender, on headers, the guy is almost like unbeatable. I mean, I'm not a big stats guy, but I'd be curious to see, you know, his percentage on air duels for a defender. It's got to be a really pretty impressive. Although he's not left-footed, he's a better passer than Romagnoli, so I give him an edge there. Now, I'm a big Romagnoli fan. Like I said, he impressed me in the second half of last season. This season, he had a couple of bad games. He had one big error against Empoli. But aside from that, I still think he's been pretty good. So I see them as close. I think I'm with you. I think Skriniar has a little bit more of a margin for like reaching the elite level. But I could see Romagnoli. I think, you know, if you ask me who's going to be the best Italian defender once Chiellini and Bonucci, you know, move on, retire, I would definitely say Romagnoli. And I do think, you know, he has the potential to maybe get to what we're saying Skriniar's ceiling is, but I think Skriniar has a better chance of getting there.
Yeah, and something that always stuck with me with Skriniar is you actually had tweeted a quote from Dries Mertens. This was back in like October of 2017. Inter had played Napoli, and Dries Mertens had said after the match, "I congratulated Skriniar. He's a wall. All of Inter's defensive line followed his orders." And David, for me, when a center back is that commanding at 22 years old, he was 22 then, that's pretty awesome. So I'm a big Milan Skriniar fan. Maybe that's why it was so easy for me to answer it. So David, the next logical question would be, which of the two is more likely to be available?
It's a great question. And like long and short of it, I don't think either is particularly available. For me, very simply, Milan's at the point that they cannot lose any of their very good players. I mean, Milan's at the point where they need to keep adding a very good players to kind of, you know, Inter's definitely ahead of them in their project. I mean, Inter to me is like very legit contender for a Champions League spot, almost at the point that if they don't get a Champions League spot, it'd be rather shocking for me. While Milan's in contention to get to a Champions League spot. So for me, Milan absolutely has to keep adding talent. Both of these teams have strong ownership groups right now. Milan, you know, and we'll get to it in the questions, are in the process actually of negotiating with UEFA a voluntary agreement to kind of be proactive with their financial fair play issues. Inter, on the other hand, have had their issues, but they've so far have had an amazing track record of addressing their financial fair play parameters without having to sell any big name player. And they usually do it, you know, by selling some of their best players from the Primavera for, you know, pretty substantial fees. And as long as they can get away with that, God bless them. So I think it's rather hard for either. I think Skriniar has been very vocal about how much he wants to stay at Inter. And look, you know, I take all those quotes with a, you know, grain of salt. You know, everyone always says they want to stay and it's great right until they want to leave or, you know, it becomes clear that they are leaving. But, you know, there was rumors and it seemed for a little while that Skriniar was just a matter of time till he'd get an extension with Inter, and then that didn't happen. So he's Romagnoli signed a big contract more recently than Skriniar, so in that sense he's more secure there. So we'll see. I think there's definitely at the moment a bigger market for Skriniar. Last summer Manchester United went after him. He has been linked to Barcelona, so let's see what happens there. So when I look at the team's perspective, neither team really has to sell. It really comes down to the player's will. You know, Romagnoli became Milan's captain. Granted, so was Bonucci, and that didn't stop him from leaving. But I see it a little bit differently as to how Romagnoli, in a lot of ways, earned that captain armband, while to Bonucci it was kind of given because of the cachet he had as a player when he arrived. So, look, you know, a lot can change. Right now it's October. I always say, you know, beware of transfer rumors during, you know, so early in the season, especially during international breaks when a lot of, you know, papers and sites need people activity on their pages. So let's see with that. Interestingly, Skriniar was asked specifically about Manchester United. And, you know, I tweeted the quote today and a few people asked me, you know, what's so significant that the word Mourinho's Manchester United was included in the quote. And I would just want to say, you know, that was a question from the Italian press. And there's obviously a big connection between Mourinho and Inter. So that's why it was included in the question. I wouldn't read anything beyond that. Like, you know, maybe if Mourinho leaves, he'd be more inclined to want to go because Skriniar took the high road and said he wasn't interested. So let's see what happens. As of now, I mean, definitely in January, I doubt either of them is leaving. Milan's really at the stage where they're adding players, and we'll get to that shortly in the questions. Inter, you know, they have De Vrij. I think having a long-term partnership of De Vrij and Skriniar at center back, I mean, that sounds really pretty fantastic. De Vrij, you know, is in the middle, early parts of his prime. He's fantastic. Skriniar hasn't even gone to his prime. Inter could be all set for a long time, and Inter's ownership does have very deep pockets, so they are doing a good job with financial fair play. So I guess it ultimately would have to come down to Skriniar demanding a move. So that's the take on that. So because there are no Serie A games, we don't have thousand names picks. Juve fans, you can have a week off from outrage over what he has to say, but he'll be back next week. One thing we can always count on are great questions from our listeners, Twitter followers. So as always, if you have a question for the podcast, make sure you use the Kyle Chilan hashtag. It makes it a lot easier for me to include it in the pod. As always, send us questions on Serie A, transfers, TV, music, journalism. We have a few of those today, as well as journalism and podcasting. And which ones are we going to go over today, Alex?
All right, David, let's start off with this Twitter question. What are your expectations for Ventura taking over at Chievo?
So I kind of have a hot take. I have to say this has been a great week for former Italy manager Ventura. Not only did he get a job at Chievo, and I actually think he's very well suited for this. He's has a lot of experience in the battle to avoid relegation, which maybe is a sign that he was in over his head with the Azzurri and the expectations that come for that. But when it comes to these sorts of battles, he's very battle-tested. I think at Chievo now, because they still have negative points after their deduction for the inflated plusvalenze, there are low expectations. I'm not saying it's a completely desperate situation, but close to it. So I feel like if Chievo gets relegated, you know, he won't get totally blamed because he inherited a tough situation. And I personally feel that Chievo has underachieved. I've tweeted it a few times. They have a very solid defense. They have a well above average goalkeeper in Sorrentino. And for the teams at the lower end of the table, Giaccherini and Birsa is a very talented offensive duo. So I think Ventura is in a great situation for himself there. Low expectation, potential to do well. And on top of that, Italy continues to struggle. And look, I don't take joy in seeing the Azzurri struggle. I really don't. I really support them. But I've been on the bandwagon that the talent just isn't there. So, you know, while Ventura gets a job, Mancini, it's his fifth match with the Azzurri. He has yet to win. Out of the last 14 matches, the Azzurri have only scored 10 goals. And granted, some of that was with Ventura. But there's really a huge lack of talent. So, again, I go back to the fact that two things can be true at the same time. It was certainly true that Ventura should have done a much better job with the Azzurri. But also maybe the team wasn't as good as we're making it out to be. It's not just the individual players. It's also the fact that a lot of those individual players, when it comes for Italy, have been really pretty terrible, some of the best ones. So I think this was a very good week for him. And I expect him to do quite well with Chievo. He's starting to manage them now during the international break. So I'm curious to see how they do. Again, I don't want anyone to construe this answer as me defending and justifying the way Ventura did as a Azzurri coach, especially the way he tried to hang on. But maybe, you know, what he had at his disposal wasn't as good as most people thought.
All right, David, how about this? And this is a very interesting question, and I didn't even know this, but why is there only one non-Italian manager currently in Serie A? Is this because of financial reasons or playing style?
Great question. And just like you, it never dawned on me until we got this question. So technically, it's two foreign managers in Serie A. And when the one that the listener referred to, I'm almost certain, was Udinese manager Velasquez, who started the season with them. He's the youngest manager in Serie A. So now we technically have a second one because Juric took over for Ballardini at Genoa. And I'm going to do a quick rant on that. On Monday, it looked like Ballardini was going to hold on to his job at Genoa. I think it was absurd that he was even on the hot seat. Genoa has actually 10 more points than at this time last season. Ballardini took over midway through the season from Juric, and avoided relegation so far this season. I'm sure he had something to do with Piontek's amazing start. Genoa, to me, they're only, you know, they missed. They have one game they have to make up. If they can somehow beat Milan, they would have been right there almost for a Champions League spot. So I'm absolutely befuddled that he got sacked, but it looks like it was a personal thing with Preziosi. So that rant aside, now we only have two foreign managers in Serie A. That's an interesting question. I mean, ultimately, I think it comes down to the fact that, quite frankly, I think Italian managers, it's hard to do better than them. We see their success abroad as well. I think they're very prepared at Coverciano, the school where most of them study. To me, that's like the Oxford of football. I do think there's also some financial reasons for them. You know, at the lower end of the table, the managers don't make that much, and it's probably harder to attract an established foreign manager. So this was a very interesting question. And just like you, Alex, it didn't dawn on me that that was the case. So I think financial is maybe 30%. I think 70% has to do with ability and also knowing calcio as a whole.
Yeah, it's certainly very interesting. How about this Twitter question, David? And this one is a hot subject because I never saw this player coming to Milan. What do you think about Lucas Paqueta's transfer to Milan?
Well, first off, I think this shows Milan's ambition and how differently the club operates now. So we knew once they hired Leonardo as a great tracker discovering Brazilian talents that that would be an area they would look at. If you know anything about Milan's history, they have a great track record with Brazilian players. Kind of the cliche, Argentines do great at Inter, Brazilians on Milan. So on paper, looks really good. Milan made a substantial financial investment to make it happen. They beat the competition of PSG in Man City on this. My friend Fabrizio Romano wrote a very interesting article on this. Leonardo basically convinced the player, and I think for a very good point, that he'd have more opportunities to play right away at Milan. So a great, I think for the club, that speaks highly. Now, look, you know, I've never watched Paqueta beyond some YouTube videos, so I don't feel qualified to describe him as a player. But, you know, there are some people that cover the Brazilian, you know, league that know a lot about it. So I asked Paulo Freitas, who's a great scout for Brazilian players, how he would describe him. And he said he's a midfielder with good passing vision and technique, can take free kicks, can play as attacking midfielder in a more central position. And he says he thinks he can do well in Italy. And another person that I follow for Brazilian players who's really good is David Mossi. He used to produce a show with Eric Winaldo on Sirius. He now works on Alexi Lalas podcast. And this is how he described him. He said, very talented player, but it's unclear what his best position is. The conversion to deep-lying playmakers, what made him so intriguing. But recently, he's returned to a more attacking role. So it's going to be interesting. I mean, if he can really play as a deep-lying playmaker, we've talked a lot about how Milan doesn't have really an alternative to Biglia, who is an older player long-term. So that could work really well. There are some people that have compared him to Kaká. So let's see if that turns out to be true or not. It's interesting that Paulo Freitas, when he was asked if resemblance to Kaká, he said that Paqueta is more of a creator while Kaká was more of a finisher. But anyways, kudos to Milan. Great to see them making these sorts of moves again.
All right. Yeah, that's certainly a very impressive, at least on paper, acquisition there for Milan, because I can speak back to the summer as a Chelsea fan. Paqueta was rumored to maybe interest Chelsea. So the fact that Milan out of nowhere gobble him up, very well done to them, at least for right now. So, David, the next Twitter question, we have a question from our friends at Milan Weekly Pod, and they ask, when do you think Gattuso will be forced to switch to a 4-4-2 and play Higuain and Cutrone together?
So shout out to Milan Weekly Pod. If you want more Serie A in your earbuds, that would be a great place to start. So, I saw a few Milan fans been asking us about this, the 4-4-2, and I wonder if this has more to do with the fact that Cutrone has been doing so well and a potential of him partnering with Higuain. I mean, my reservations on this are, you know, where does that leave Sousa? He's like really natural in the 4-3-3 as an offensive winger. I kind of like Calhanoglu and Bonaventura being switching between the midfield and the more offensive role. So I'm not so sure. I'm less on the bandwagon of Milan switching formation. I actually think they've been doing pretty well recently with the 4-3-3. But it's also interesting that Gattuso is going to have to try to find a creative way to get more playing time for Cutrone.
Okay, David, next Twitter question. Plain and simple, is Gasperini on the hot seat?
I would say if Atalanta had any other manager, he would absolutely be on the hot seat. A lot of talk of firing him. I don't think I could be very wrong. I don't think the Atalanta's won 7 matches in a row that they haven't won. They've looked really anemic. To me, Atalanta, we've seen Serie A teams that when they used to lose in the preliminary round of the Champions League, we saw it happening to Napoli and Lazio, how that was a hangover for the season. They never really recovered. Maybe Atalanta has this version with the Europa League. So I think Gasperini's certainly his track record, what he's done at Atalanta, he definitely deserves time. He also has a very long contract. I think it's through 2022, which for Italy is almost unheard of. Almost every manager only has a 2-year deal in Italy. So I don't think he's on the hot seat, but Atalanta really has to get on track. They are much closer to the relegation zone, just 1 point, than they are to a Europa League spot, which was originally their goal. So let's see what happens. I think there are reasons for concerns. I mean, Atalanta stacked up front, but maybe not so much in other areas, especially on the wings. They seem rather weak.
All right, David, how about this? Sampdoria, Fiorentina, and Sassuolo are still in the top 8. Where do you see them finishing?
So right now, Sampdoria is 5th, Fiorentina 7th, and Sassuolo is 8th. So for any club that has to go down, it means there has to be some that go up. So if these clubs exit the top 8, it means that some others are going to have to replace them. I think it's safe to say Milan's going to pass probably all of them. I'd be surprised if they don't. Keep in mind, Milan has 1 less game played, and that's against Genoa. But Milan's definitely more talented than all those teams. Beyond that, there's really not that many other teams in Serie A that I would take over these 3. I think Torino has a chance. They have a pretty deep squad. They invested a lot in the summer. So I think Milan's going to pass all of them. I could see Torino passing Sassuolo. I'm not sure they are better than Sampdoria. I see them as about the same. So I see Fiorentina and Milan being above these, and then maybe Sampdoria. I do think Sassuolo, there is going to be, they are going to take a step back, but maybe De Zerbi, a manager we've been very high on the podcast, will continue to surprise.
Okay, next Twitter question. This is straight up, David. Who was a better player between Totti and Pirlo?
Man, this is a tough one, and I was like, maybe I need to ponder this question and keep it for Monday and think about it over the weekend. And I think I would have tortured myself thinking that. So first off, you know, it's harder to compare them. We've gotten a lot of questions on Totti versus Del Piero, and because they essentially played the same position, it's a little bit easier to compare. Totti and Pirlo obviously played different roles. So as far as who's better, I was really thinking a lot about this. I think, gun to the head, I would take Totti. I mean, a lot of our younger listeners know Totti as like the icon that came off the bench for Roma. And even in 2006, when Italy won the World Cup, I mean, he really wasn't a key player on that team like Pirlo was. But before then, Totti was really, really sensational. So this might sound like a cop-out. I'm going to say that Totti was a better player, but Pirlo had a better career. And this may also go back to Totti's choice at staying at Roma. But I also look at Pirlo, how he kind of had a second phase of his career when he left Milan and joined Juve. You have to wonder, had maybe Totti done somewhat of an equivalent move? I mean, definitely seeing him on another Serie A team would have been really pretty much impossible. So maybe it sounds like a cop-out, but I'm going to go talk the better player, not by much, but Pirlo, definitely better career.
All right, David, now that you've answered that, let's move away from football. Will Trent Reznor / Nine Inch Nails make it into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? And which of the artists nominated this year has a better chance of getting inducted?
So I'll answer the second question first. These are most of the nominees for this year. I have Def Leppard, Radiohead, MC5, Janet Jackson, The Cure, Kraftwerk, Rage Against the Machine, Roxy Music, and My Boys. Actually, I already mentioned Radiohead. So out of these, I would say The Cure would almost be a lock to me. I mean, those guys have a huge catalog, incredibly influential band. I would say Radiohead are a lock, but they are fairly recent. I think they're incredibly influential and original band, but I also don't wonder how much Radiohead actually cares about being in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and maybe they hold that against them. So to me, those are locks. I think Def Leppard, considering their catalog, they have some of the best-selling albums of all time. You know, definitely have a lot of songs that people still listen to now, should be a lock. MC5, a very influential band, should get in as well. And although, you know, it's not a rock artist, but Janet Jackson definitely has had a very substantial career. Kraftwerk, a band, German band, who was really very original and influenced all sorts of bands, including Radiohead, are an interesting pick as well. So, you know, it's an interesting group this year. So let's see who gets in. As far as Nine Inch Nails and Trent Reznor, I'm a huge fan, actually going to see them when they come to Boston next week, both shows. I mean, to me, they should be a lock to get in. And I was thinking maybe if Nine Inch Nails, which ultimately is just Trent Reznor, all that's changed now, maybe as an artist, because of the work he's done on soundtracks, and he's done some of the most iconic soundtracks recently. He, of course, did the soundtrack to The Social Network, which I think is the best soundtrack maybe of the millennium so far. He's done a lot of the movies with Fincher, maybe because of his work on the soundtracks. I don't know how much that helps Nine Inch Nails. And again, it's all one and the same. He should get in. But I have a feeling they're going to be a little bit more picky with Nine Inch Nails than some of the other bands. But in my mind, they should absolutely be in.
All right. Fair enough. David, last Twitter question. What are your favorite Nicolas Cage films?
So this question pissed me off for a variety of reasons. A, because it forced me to do some research. I hadn't seen a lot of Nicolas Cage movies in a long time. And B, because the person who submitted this question, this is my friend David Tenenbaum, who I've known for a very long time, is probably not even going to listen to the podcast. So he made me do all this research and then won't even listen to the payoff. So what was interesting is when he submitted this question and I responded right away, oh, this is a good one, but I have to do research. Had a few of our other listeners chime in and be like, oh my God, you guys actually like Nicolas Cage. And for younger viewers, I mean, Nicolas Cage has had a very up and down career. Recently, he got in so much debt, owed so much money that he basically would take any movie that paid him well. He's done some pretty horrible ones. And even some of the action movies that he's done, you know, very successful, but were basically caricatures. Face Off with John Travolta, completely over the top film. Con Air, where he has a completely ridiculous accent and one of the most ludicrous action scenes with like a huge plane landing on the Vegas Strip. So I could totally see why someone's like, how is this guy even a serious actor? The Rock was maybe a little bit more of a serious action movie that was a little bit better than the others. So I can see why a lot of people look at Nicolas Cage as not a serious actor, but he's actually a really, really good actor. And he has some movies dating back to the 80s that I've really enjoyed. So as far as his best movies, I picked a few. He did a movie with David Lynch. Granted, it's not vintage David Lynch, but any David Lynch movie is better than average. And that's Wild at Heart. He did an awesome movie with the Coen brothers, Raising Arizona, which is a really good one. He won an Oscar for Leaving Las Vegas, where he was a guy basically trying to drink himself to death. It's a very good movie. But I will say what I think is his best performance and his best movie is Adaptation, which was a Spike Jonze movie where Nicolas Cage plays two twins And that's a great performance. It's a great film. It features Meryl Streep as well. So if you're into movies and you want to understand why some people actually rate Nicolas Cage, I would start with Adaptation and then go with Raising Arizona and Leave Us Las Vegas next. Okay, so as always, thank you so much to our listeners that submit questions. If you have a question for an upcoming podcast, please use the Couchland hashtag. You guys are essentially co-writers of the podcast with me. And we also rely on you for being our marketing department. So if you enjoy what you hear, it's a free podcast that Alex and I put a lot of effort in. Please tell your friends, tweet about us. And a thing you can do, which only takes 5 seconds of your time, is leave us a rating on iTunes. If you're listening on an iPhone, please, on your podcast app, search for Couchland, find us, scroll down on ratings, tap 5 stars. You wouldn't believe how much that helps. And if you want to leave a comment, you know that Alex and I read them all. So now for the first interview of the podcast, we are going to be joined by my colleague from DiMarzio site, Stephen Moore, who covers Lazio on a site called The Laziale. We had some tech issues at my end. It's not Alex or Steve's fault, so I apologize for the audio. My part doesn't sound great, but hopefully this is something that won't happen again. So without further ado, here's Steve, and we're going to take a deep dive on Lazio. So for the first interview of today's podcast, I am thrilled to welcome for the first time on the podcast one of my colleagues on the DiMarzio site, Stephen K. Moore. You can follow him on Twitter at @S_K_Moore. He's been on my team on the DiMarzio site for quite some time now. He's also the founder of the Laziale website. So we're here to chat up about Lazio. We haven't taken a deep dive on them in a while. So Steve, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
Fantastic. How are you guys doing?
Fantastic. So it's great to have you on board. So let's talk about Lazio. And I thought a good place to start was ask you your assessment of the season so far. It's been a little bit up and down, but at the beginning of the season, is this what you expected?
Quite honestly, not a lot of people expected Lazio to do as well as they did last season. My thoughts personally, after the first 2 games of the season, is lackluster. We saw them lose 2 games right away at the beginning of the season. They did go on a good run of winning 5 in a row, but then they kind of hit a little turn in the curve there and lost that derby. Obviously, had a huge impact on all of Laziale, but I believe they can do more. We saw as many goals they had last year, number one in the league in the Serie A, but this year it's kind of same as the Azzurri, just trying to find goals into the back of the net. It's kind of a difficult situation, it looks like.
So, Steve, after the summer, for me, my biggest question mark on Lazio was on the defense, because I thought the loss of De Vrij was really, really substantial. I kind of saw him as one of the core players on the team. And Acerbi from Sassuolo was brought in to replace him. So I wanted to ask you, what's been your take on Acerbi so far? Have you seen a big drop-off since De Vrij left? Are you satisfied with his performances?
I am 100% satisfied with his performance since he's joined the club. Obviously, the departure of De Vrij, he was a huge figure. Signed him after the 2014 World Cup after great performances. He was a key component of Lazio's team. He was basically the core in the middle of defense too in Zaghi's 3-5-1-1 formation. So Acerbi had a lot to take on coming into this Lazio side that had been so structured from last year, playing consistently with some or most of the same players over and over again, chosen by Inzaghi. So he's come in, he's done a terrific job. You can see him being a leader on the field, on and off the dressing room, in my opinion. We see that he's taking control of the games. He's also the exact opposite of injury prone, it looks like. We see him trying to challenge Zanetti's record for the most consecutive games in the Serie A, but he's been terrific. Exactly what we wanted as Laziale fans for an replacement for De Vrij.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you there. So I have to ask you, though, other than Acerbi, it's very hard for me to determine who is the other best defender on Lazio, even if there is one. So I wanted to ask you, gun to the head, if you had to pick another defender on Lazio that has the best chance of being someone reliable, who would that be?
Consistency is key, so I'm going to have to go with the Romanian Stefan Radu. Of course, we saw Luis Felipe kind of shine at the end of last year and kind of take over that right center back role at the club, but he got injured at the beginning of the season. Wallace came in and had a few good games, shut down Ronaldo, obviously taking his jersey at the end of that match, but Radu's been there every single game. He's been with the club for quite some time now, so other than Achebe, I think Radu is next best in line.
Okay, so now let's move to a topic near and dear to the podcast. We are huge fans of Milinkovic-Savic. Last season, he made us look really, really good. Not so much this season. So I have to ask you, what do you think is wrong with him? Do you think this is a matter of, you know, if he was linked to all these big clubs and maybe he's disappointed that a move didn't happen? Do you think maybe all the hype and the fact that he signed, you know, significant extension with Lazio went to the head, maybe a combination of the two? What's your take on what's been wrong with him so far?
My take, we just saw Ili Tare speak yesterday to La Repubblica about what he personally thinks is the issue, and he says that him returning late from the World Cup and all the transfer speculation has gotten to his head, and I personally think that is the biggest issue. Young players these days, they have these breakout seasons, and then top clubs are always rumored to sign them, especially for the amount of money that was going around from Milinkovic-Savic that Lotito would put on his head. Obviously, that's going to get to a player. We saw him pick up performance last year around October. So for me, I think it's just the time to get into the team once again and into the season. But I don't think anything is wrong with him. I think it just needs time to get used to the squad in general for the season.
Okay, so now let's talk about another player that's drawn the ire of Ultra fans. We had Lazio's fans post a banner against Milinkovic-Savic, and the other one was Luis Alberto, basically saying that they only care about money. So you've given us your take on Milinkovic-Savic. What do you think the deal is with Luis Alberto? And also as a caveat to this, you think Correa, who came in as a late summer move, do you think he can, have you seen enough from him to feel pretty confident he can make up for the loss of Felipe Anderson, who of course left for West Ham?
For sure. So Luis Alberto, I don't like to talk about one-hit wonders, but he was at Liverpool for quite some time, was sent on loan, didn't really make an impact in the Premier League. And then he came to Lazio, they'd given him a chance. The first year we saw him sat on the bench for almost every game. He scored one goal, I believe, at the end of the season. But last year, he obviously took off. It was a great connection between him and Immobile, and it worked perfectly with Inzaghi's formation. This year, we're not seeing too much of him. And once again, he is coming off of injury, and players always need that time to get back on the right track. But his creativity and his effort seems to be lacking. We saw at the end of the derby that a lot of the players had apparently gone to him to talk to them to see what was going on, because they were kind of not impressed with his performances that he'd been putting in. But Correa should, as I've seen so far, be able to not replace him, but kind of be that vice to Luis Alberto, to give him more of a challenge so he wants to fight for his starting position on the team. Obviously, when it's just you in that position, you kind of just stroll around every single game with the opinion that I'm going to play every single game no matter what. So with Correa coming into the side, it is good for him and also for Correa, because it gives him to the ability to show his talent and skill. We did see him with Sampdoria back when he was in the Serie A, but he's been in Spain for quite some time now. So he looks very skillful, attack-minded-wise. Defensive, not so much, but that's not what we need for him. We need him to be assisting Immobile and getting up the pitch higher. So I believe he does have the capabilities to help both Luis Alberto and Lazio.
Excellent. So now let's talk about another key player on Lazio. This is Ciro Immobile. So there was a lot of outrage that he wasn't, you know, in the nominees for the awards for the best players, the Ballon d'Or, but we saw Benzema be selected. And my joke was like, hey, maybe they only watched him play for Italy and I'm watching him at the club level, because the drop-off is really incredible. Like, I think personally Immobile doesn't nearly get enough credit for being really a fantastic Serie A striker. I've said this many times, there aren't that many strikers that have three seasons with 20 goals under their belt in Serie A. You can look at the list, you'll be really impressed to see who's on it, and more importantly, who's not on it. But why do you think Immobile is just so much better for Lazio than he is with the Azzurri? I mean, it's just really kind of shocking. When you watch him play for Italy, you just don't understand why he's so good in Serie A.
What's going on exactly? This is one that, just looking at all the strikers that Italy have had, obviously the numbers, they don't have that key striker right now. Like Balotelli is the main person. He's played the most games. He's got the most goals for them. But all the other strikers, they haven't produced. You look at Zaza, you look at Belotti, Bernardeschi is obviously coming up, and Insigne. The numbers aren't producing. Immobile is a striker, and he has those 320-plus goal seasons in the Serie A. But I believe it's kind of the formation and the players that he's playing with. Obviously, in Lazio, he's been used to that 3-5-1-1 or the 3-5-2 formation with the wingers out wide. We see with Italy, since 2018, since Mancini's taken over, since Di Biagio was in charge, even before that, they're used to that 4 formation at the back. Italy obviously did, with Conte, have that 3 formation, but Immobile wasn't too involved at that time. I just believe it's the formation and the players that he's been playing with at the end of the day. Obviously, his work ethic is there. He's running around, going left and right, but Immobile is not that striker from what I've seen since he's joined Lazio to score just that one chance that a team has in a game. He's usually given 3-4 chances, and he puts one or two of them away. With Italy, he seems to maybe get a chance or two, but he's either missing the net, he's putting it over, the goalie's saving it. It's not the same as Lazio in the Serie A. And obviously, the competition and on a national level, wearing that Azzurri shirt is probably pressing on him. But yeah.
So great analysis there. I took it a step further. That's some interesting points that I hadn't thought of. So let's close on this. Lazio's been up and down so far to start the season. We have some great performances, some not so great performances. Where do you expect Lazio to finish when it's all said and done?
I believe they're going to try to challenge for that fourth place spot again. All in all, it kind of depends on Inzaghi, if he's willing to change the formation, if he's willing to stick with the same formation, if the players are able to react like they had done last year. Secondly, also the players' desire and their ability to stay match fit. This is kind of key, as we saw last year, that if Immobile and Luis Alberto hadn't gotten injured, Lazio would have absolutely secured that Champions League spot that they wanted so bad and deserved last year. But I believe that they are going to challenge for that fourth spot. Obviously, Juventus, Napoli, Inter, I believe, are going to be up there, but they'll be challenging Roma and Milan, I believe, in fourth.
So, Steve, you did a fantastic job in your debut. As always, you guys can read Steve on Di Marzio's site, and if you're a Lazio fan, definitely check out the site that he founded, Del Laziale. A lot of great analysis there. Steve's been growing a lot. You can hear him on a lot of podcasts. And after you heard him today on Calcioland, you can hear why. So, Steve, thanks so much for joining us. It was a real pleasure to have you on.
Thank you guys for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, guys. So we have a bonus interview on the podcast today. And Alex, our co-producer, co-host, has been blowing up with his videos on Twitter. Now he has a YouTube channel. He's really becoming a big star. So I wanted to catch up with Alex, who you guys by now know is a big Chelsea fan, to talk a little bit about Sarri. And if you're a Serie A fan, you know, pissed that we're talking about the PL, this is your signal that you can log off now. But for a lot of our listeners, this isn't an intriguing topic. So, Alex, flat out, you and I talked a lot on the special on Sarri and even when he was at Napoli, about his good side, his not so good side. So let me ask you, what has surprised you the most about him since he became Chelsea's manager?
Well, I really want to say two things, David. But first off, I would just say that he hasn't ruffled one feather, not one feather. The only thing he's even said wrong, David, is something you and I joked about how once a game is 2-0 in Serie A, it's over. But that didn't even have to do anything with the Premier League or with Chelsea. He hasn't ruffled one feather. And someone may say, well, why did you expect him to? He's a new manager. He's probably going to need to be on his P's and Q's. But no, he was coming into a situation where, of course, things ended very toxic with Antonio Conte. But because Chelsea have been playing a defensive style even past Conte for a handful of years now, he was coming into a situation where the team he had at hand at Chelsea was not exactly tailor-made for Sarri. There are veterans who don't really fit into the picture, like a Gary Cahill, Victor Moses, a few more, that may become, I don't know, frustrated if they're completely shunned and they're not paid attention to. But it seems like he has, in a short amount of time, taken a little bit of care and a little bit of time on every single player that's in front of him, which is very difficult for a new manager to do, especially since the fact, David, they haven't lost a game. So all the while, he's managed to start off perfect with, in terms of no losses. He's had an exceptional start with his new club, but there's really nobody who's that angered. Now, Gary Cahill spoke out about a month ago, said he wasn't happy with his playing time, but it wasn't a dig at Sarri, and it was totally just that Gary Cahill has been an important part in the Premier League at Chelsea, and he wants to play more. But everybody, every player who's spoken about Sarri has just glowing, glowing reviews. And sure, I don't expect anybody to diss him or to insult him, but sometimes you can kind of gauge if it's genuine or not. And David, I would just say the most surprising thing is he hasn't put one foot wrong in all of these press conferences. Anytime he's been asked a question, everybody can only say positive things about Sarri. He has a perfect report card so far, David, minus that funny little thing he said about Serie A.
You know, the press conference part is really interesting to me. That I agree with. That's what surprised me the most. But I really go back to the fact that a lot of people make fun of De Laurentiis, Napoli's president, about his press conferences. But I go back to the fact that the city of Naples, the club of Naples, are really a pretty unique situation. And I almost wonder if Sarri, when he was there, felt like he had to be, you know, quite frankly, pretty vulgar at times and be very passionate and, you know, maybe shoot from the hip a little bit more. This isn't a dig at Napoli. I mean, it's a city that's got a lot of amazing qualities. So I'm starting to think that maybe, you know, people there feel like they have to play a certain character. So let me ask you, on the players on Chelsea, which ones do you think have benefited the most from Sarri so far?
Well, everybody can predict my first answer, David. It's certainly Eden Hazard. Now, it feels like Hazard, it doesn't matter if it's the international break or the clubs are in session. Hazard is all over Twitter, whether it's me claiming he's second best in the world right now or it's a transfer rumor. He's everywhere. But we all predicted, and by we, I mean all Chelsea fans, we all predicted you give Eden Hazard an attacking manager and we're finally going to see what he can really do. And David, that has just proved to be flat out correct and then some. He's the best player in the Premier League right now, that's for sure. The one thing with Hazard is he never had high goal tallies, but it was once again referred to the fact that he just played under defensive managers. And so far, he's leading the Premier League in goals scored. He has 7 goals, 3 assists. He has more goals in all competitions. Sarri has done simply what Chelsea fans have been asking for years and years and years. Let Hazard play the football he wants to play. So Hazard's the easy answer because, I mean, Sarri might be the saving grace of keeping Eden Hazard at Stamford Bridge. If Sarri didn't come along, I would be way more pessimistic about the chances of Eden Hazard staying at Chelsea. Sarri has been an absolute godsend for Eden Hazard. I would also say, and I'm really going to eat crow on this one because this is a player I've been quite vocal in saying I'm not a big fan of. Actually, two players, David. Two players, damn it. Two. David Luiz and Marcos Alonso have really been benefited by Maurizio Sarri's arrival. David Luiz, because Sarri was looking for a good passing center back, but also with some experience and some leadership qualities, which David Luiz definitely does have. Sarri was willing to kind of overlook David Luiz's defensive capabilities or lack thereof, I should say. I always say that David Luiz is the king of brain farts, and he is. But David Luiz has been benefited by Maurizio Sarri because Sarri wants good passing center backs. David Luiz is absolutely that. And when Maurizio Sarri arrived, he really wanted to be able to lean on someone who'd been at the club for a while. And David Luiz is someone who has certainly been at the club for a while. So it was perfect for David Luiz. David Luiz was non-existent last year with Antonio Conte, even when he wasn't injured. He just wasn't in the picture. And then, as I said, Marcos Alonso. If we look back to Napoli, David, we always talked about the fact that Sarri likes to build his attacks on the left-hand side. He had Goulam last year building it up with Lorenzo Insigne, and that has absolutely been true at Chelsea as well. Marcos Alonso is a very attacking type left back, and Marcos Alonso has not really had to revert back to playing a pure defensive position. He played left wing back under Conte, but it's almost like a left back in Sarri's system. It's closer to a left wing back. The right back is way different. Hisaj would always stay behind almost as an extra center back. That's kind of what Azpilicueta is doing. So Marcos Alonso really has not had to make many changes to his game. So I would say Eden Hazard one. But then David Luiz and Marcos Alonso, also two players that needed Maurizio Sarri, in my opinion.
So, guys, you didn't hit by accident the increased speed on the podcast to make it talk faster. This is how Alex talks when he's really passionate. So, I know you guys that follow his videos know all about it. So, I love the passion. You didn't hit speed and Hazard, and I hate to bring it up. I feel like Hazard has become now the one player that has the most transfer rumors every international break. I feel like he took this title from Verratti, and now Hazard has it. So you hinted a little bit at it again. So let me ask you, how concerned are you that after this season, Hazard could potentially leave?
I'm no more concerned today than I was a week ago that I was in August. In August, I felt like he definitely wasn't leaving this last summer, but I felt like this next summer it was 50-50. His contract is coming to an end soon after the next year, but obviously the Real Madrid rumors have been hot and heavy for a little while now. But here's my stance on it, David. This week, the international break has really shown its true colors. As you said earlier in the podcast, it kind of feels like every reporter kind of has got to fill up their site with something during the international break. So the big players, especially big players with rumors on them, get asked the same question over and over. Hazard at this point has heard Real Madrid more than he's heard the name Chelsea, more than he's heard Sarri, more than he's probably heard his own kids' names. He constantly hears Real Madrid. So he's at the point where he's not playing games with people, but today he was asked in a Belgian press conference, he was asked, does he need to go to Spain to win the Ballon d'Or? And he said, well, yeah, that's why I want to go to Spain, maybe. And he said it with a smirk and a chuckle, and so many Chelsea fans got so upset, and they're like, oh God, now he's saying he wants to go to Spain. You got to read in between the lines with this guy. He's been at Chelsea for 6+ years, and yet it feels like 80% of the Chelsea fan base still doesn't know his personality. He's a jokester. He's a kidder. At this point, he's almost mocking the reporters, not disrespectfully, but they're putting words in his mouth. So he decides to just say the words right back at them. David, I think 50-50, he leaves this summer, but nothing that's happened this week has changed my mind. I only see him going to one team, and that's Real Madrid. And Real Madrid, there's reports that they could be easily more interested in Neymar or Mbappe. So I only see Hazard going to Real Madrid, but then if they don't want Hazard, if he's not their first priority, if they go for Neymar or Mbappe, Hazard's staying at Chelsea, and he might stay at Chelsea for the rest of his career for all we know. He's not going to PSG. He's not going to Bayern Munich. He's not going to another Premier League club. Barcelona rumors really haven't been that popular at all. So I only see Real Madrid, and with Real Madrid, I still see them preferring Neymar or Mbappe. So I'm saying 50-50, Eden Hazard stays at Chelsea.
I love it. I'm with you. I always say, you know, I never take quotes on transfers seriously. And every time people are like, oh, why is he talking so much about it? As you pointed out, he's answering the questions that he's asked. And I couldn't agree more with you. It's either Chelsea or Real Madrid, nothing else. More than, you know, what he's saying, the only thing that I would say is the age. He's at the point in his career that if he wants to go to Real Madrid and be there for part of his prime, that window is closing. But you had made a good point all summer that it would have been foolish for Chelsea to entertain selling him before he could actually play for Sarri and experience that. So let me close on this. I think at the beginning of the season, correct me if I'm wrong, you would have probably signed for qualifying for the Champions League, considering, you know, the competition in the Champions League and Sarri coming in a little bit late, and we assumed it would take time for the players to adapt to his system, and that hasn't been the case. But now, you know, that we're into the season, you've gotten a taste, the results have been really good. What's your minimum expectation for Chelsea? Like, what's the line where you're going to be disappointed if they don't hit at least that target?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would be really disappointed if they were anything worse than third place, meaning if they were fourth place, that's unacceptable. I expect a top three finish from Chelsea. I really do. At this point, City are absolutely still the favorites in the Premier League. Now, City, Liverpool, and Chelsea are all tied on points, but my thing with Chelsea is I think they're good enough if they're playing like they are to win the title. However, I think sooner or later throughout the course of the season, which is a marathon, it's not a sprint, I think the fact that Chelsea really lack goal scorers will be a problem at some point, which I think means they're way more likely for third than they are first place. City are just so deep. It's still City's to lose. I mean, the City have five squads within their team that could win the Premier League. Liverpool are a little bit more dependent on a few players. So maybe Chelsea could compete for second. And I think they should compete for second. Anything worse than third, though, that's a disappointment. And then Europa, I expect them to be one of the better teams in Europa. And I would view it as a disappointment if they weren't one of the final four teams in Europa. Not really going to go into the cups. It's really hard to know what Sarri will do in the cups with rotating and young players. That's a discussion for a whole nother day. So, David, my answer would be I want nothing worse than third place, and I want them to really show out in Europa League because, honestly, I know Champions League teams will fall into the Europa League once the group stage is over, but right now, Chelsea's by far the best team in the Europa League. So, yeah, third place and a good run in the Europa League.
All right, fantastic. Good job by you, Alex. Good job by Steve Moore. Made his debut on Calcioland. Again, sorry for the slight audio issues. We'll do our best to avoid those in the future. So that's our second and last episode for the week. We'll be back next week. We're going to preview the derby between Inter and Milan. Hopefully we'll have some good things to talk about the Azzurri. But as always, we want to thank you guys for the support, and we'll chat with you next week.